So I'd like to talk about commitment to this practice, commitment, dedication to this practice, and a piece of that is that in picking, deciding what it is that I wanted to talk about tonight, it was probably my most difficult subject. In many ways, I've been with this practice a little bit before I found John Travis as a teacher for me. And in many ways, I came into this practice kicking and screaming. And I'm still kicking and screaming in the sense that Buddhism is a challenge. Sitting is a challenge. And the fortunate part of it is that it's a practice. In many ways, a very long practice, as at least it's been for me. At any point, just if anybody has any questions, I use words that you don't understand, please just, feel free to ask. I know probably a lot of you come here for different reasons, and you'll probably find inspiration for coming here for a lot of different reasons. And there's and certainly in terms of looking at developing dedication with the practice, commitment to the practice, you're going to be able to look to that little piece for inspiration in terms of finding, what it is that continues to bring you back here again and again and again. My wife just got off a 10-day retreat, and she was asked at the beginning of that retreat what it was that, why was she there? She had a hard time with that, but the answer that she finally came up with was that at the end of the 10 days, having experienced a 10-day retreat before, she was a nicer person. I can vouch for that. She is definitely a nicer person at the end of those 10 days. As a matter of fact, I could like to ship her out maybe every 60 days for a 10-day retreat. I can say that because she's not here. and she also approved this message. So I started my Buddhist practice with a 10-day retreat. I walked into it cold. So it was, if you've ever been on retreat, and I'm sure a lot of you have, I'm sure you know that, many of us look to retreats for just that, it's that place where you can get the opportunity to develop a different mindset, a different way of thinking than day to day, what is frequently day to day thinking. So, in any event, I want to talk a little bit about how we apply ourselves on a day-to-day basis. What I'm going to be talking about here a little bit is a quality of mind. Just developing a sense of what that quality is. Much of what I'm in sitting down, talking, thinking about this, it's really very basic Buddhism in a lot of ways. This could be a talk about almost anything, Buddhist thinking. Basically, I'm trying to stay focused focusing your mind, focusing your practice, staying focused. Um, And it's all about where we place our mind in that practice. So first I want to just talk about a few blockers, places that give us trouble, distractions. Then I want to talk a little bit about dualistic thinking. So I've labeled here three kind of distractions that are pretty typical about day-to-day life in general. One of the things that we're faced with in terms of staying focused, in terms of continuing to look to the practice for insight, is just the enormity of the task. I've thought often about thinking about being a monk. Boy, I mean, there's something that is a real opportunity and a commitment. But I've never I've never had the opportunity to do that. And just about picking up the idea of working on enlightenment and working on developing this quality of mind for ourselves, quality of compassion for ourselves. So in many sense, it's an impossible task, but we do it anyway. So where is it that we can be empowered? I have a couple verses here that I'd like to read out of a book called The Way of the Bodhisattva. And this is a really great book written by a 19th century monk called Shantideva. And Shantideva was a simple forest monk who was kind of chided into doing a talk, actually, because he had never done a talk, and sat down, and just the way of the Bodhisattva came out of him. And this is out of a chapter on vigilance, actually. Verse 13, to cover the earth with sheets of hide, where could such amounts of skin be found? But simply wrap some leather around your feet, and it's as if the whole earth had been covered. Likewise, we can never take and turn aside the outer course of things, but only seize and discipline the mind itself. And what is there remaining to be curbed? So again, we're coming back to our mind here and realizing that the task is here. The goal is to end the poverty of mind. The goal is to end the poverty of beings, as a bodhisattva would work towards the end of the poverty of beings. And it's a large task, but we do it anyway. And practice does give us a sense that things do change. Over time, you can see perhaps maybe developing a certain softness, perhaps developing a certain sense of compassion that wasn't there before. And that's the kind of place that perhaps, when you see that happen, it's an opportunity to realize that there's something here for us. Another place that is a bit of a blocker is, just our own tentativeness with almost anything we pick up today. We're given lots of opportunities in this world. Verse 20, this is again from The Way of the Bodhisattva. For if I carefully protect my wounds because I feel the hurt of cuts and bruises, why should I not guard my wounded mind for fear of being crushed beneath the cliffs of hell? This is kind of unusual terminology for a lot of Buddhist texts. You don't hear them talking about hell very much. I think perhaps Shantideva may have had a sense of humor. But we're great sometimes at hedging our bets. We're great at being occasional opportunists. And also we listen to our own committee. This guy that goes back and forth and all over and around and he's somebody who has a great deal of influence over us. But one of the things that's important to recognize in terms of kind of what's going on is that it is a habitual mind that we bring here to ourselves. It's this mind that continues to behave and look for things the way we always look for things. We're hunters or gatherers, perhaps, at a very basic level. But it's a habitual mind that plays tricks on us. And maybe marching to the gates of hell doesn't sound like a great idea, but in some way we have to remain open to our own wounds. And part of that piece is that because they are what they are, and Buddhist practice teaches us to look and sit still with what is. It asks us to be in the present and be with what is. It's not always a comfortable place. So another blocker here is just the onslaught of our culture and the onslaught of our lives. The information overload. We get a zillion mixed messages all day from our culture. And the barrage is endless. And we're lulled here sometimes into realizing that, we're very capable at dealing with this barrage. We can turn it on, turn it off. We can pick, we can choose. But it's important to realize that it's there and it's in front of us and it's a constant presence. It's the spell of the sensuous. And again, it gets reinforced by our committee. We may as well have Rush and Dr. Laurel and Al Franklin all running nonstop. Verse 27, again from chapter 5 on vigilance. Lack of vigilance is like a thief who sinks behind when mindfulness abates, and all the merit we have gathered in, he steals, and down we go to lower realms, somewhere near hell probably, I guess. So how can we remain vigilant in the face of this assault? We are easily distracted. Or maybe another way of saying this is that we are easily attracted by what we're faced with, by what we're given, what comes to us. And again, it's important to realize that there's opportunities to interrupt what's going on, and realize that we can work with the mind, that we can stop and slow down and put the present moment in the middle of all of this onslaught. For present moment is an antidote. This is Pema Chodron, who comes from Shambhala tradition, and and who kind of turned me on to the way of the Bodhisattva. When you don't have to grasp, there's an opportunity for a fresh state to arise. So, now I want to say a few words about dependent origination here, one of my favorite subjects. Dependent origination is basically how suffering escalates, how suffering comes to us. And so this is a little primer on suffering. And basically it's what happens to us all very quickly. So this short little list here is a list that happens frequently very fast. Sometimes we don't see it. So a feeling arises, a comfortable one, uncomfortable one, neutral one. You have an emotional response. You perceive dualistically. It's a whole discussion in and of itself, certainly, but it's accepted as a given for the moment. You perceive dualistically. Then we try to interpret it. And that's when complications start to set in. We develop beliefs, etc. And then we act out of this cycle of samsara. We act out of this cycle of suffering. So it's this dualistic thinking that sets us apart, it's real important to understand that it is present in our thinking, that it is present in the way we act. And one opportunity here is to recognize that it exists. And put our awareness, put the present moment in at any point along this cycle. And as soon as you can do that, you get the opportunity to slow down. And you get the opportunity to see that you are in a cycle of suffering. So Pema says, that finding yourself in a negative state is finding yourself in a dualistic state. Kind of one place to look, one place to realize there's an opportunity for interjecting perhaps the present moment. So I brought dependent origination up here just because I believe it's one of those places to look to Buddhism, look to your practice, to understand that it's an important cycle, and just having that knowledge is for me an inspiration, and it's for me a place that I can go to come back to realizing that this is a practice that is useful to me. This is a practice that I can learn from. So one evening, a Zen master, Sri Chiri, was reciting sutras when a thief entered his house with a sharp sword, demanding your money or your life. Without any fear, Sri Chiri said, "Don't disturb me. Help yourself with the money. It's in the drawer." And he resumed his recitations. The thief was startled by this unexpected reaction, but he proceeded with his business anyway. While he was helping himself with the money, the master stopped and called out, "Don't take it all. Leave some for me to pay my taxes tomorrow." The thief left some money behind and prepared to leave. Just before he left, the master shouted at him, "You took my money and you didn't even thank me. That's not polite." This time the thief was really shocked at such fearlessness. He thanked the master and ran away. A few days later, the thief was caught and confessed his theft at Sri Chiri's house and many others. When the master was called as a witness, he said, "No, this man did not steal anything from me. I gave him the money. And he even thanked me for it." So I kind of picked this story up in part because it's kind of a story that confronts you with a number of issues all of a sudden that you want to stand up and say, it's about this, it's about that. Not unlike what we're given and what our minds have to face, a number of different issues, and how do you reconcile them all, and where do you focus? You know, for instance, there's the issue of the thief not taking what is not freely given to him. A monk who is not attached to his position, his possessions. Attachment being a great Buddhist notion. But for me, this story is also a little bit about how we perceive dualistically. It's taking that unexpected tact with the way that we think, the way that we act, that is a noble step here. And it's this unexpected mind that perhaps, you know, perhaps the monk was able to perceive the thief as his brother, as opposed to wherever else he could have gone with it. So a recent bumper sticker I saw said, "Don't believe everything you think." So for those of us who like nice moral stories, the remainder of the story is the thief was so touched that he decided to repent. And upon release from prison, he became a disciple of the master, and many years later he attained enlightenment. So another little story I have for you is one that comes out of Folsom Prison. Slightly difficult story to tell because again it's not unlike this story of the thief and the Zen priest. Because it is complicated. One evening, this is a weekly sangha, a weekly community meeting. And many of these prisoners who come to this meeting are lifers. And they're very dedicated practitioners. They come because they want to be there. Many of them need to be there in order to work with their lives. Had a member who has been coming for quite a few years, and he got sent to prison as a young man, and at this point he's been in prison for 20 years or better, and he started talking about the murder that he had committed 20 years ago, and how his process about being in prison was finding the gold in his murder. And when I first heard this, I was taken aback because there wasn't a lot of other things that I thought maybe should be present. Maybe humility about the murder or some sentiments about the life he had taken or the people that he had hurt. Maybe there really is at the present time gold for Tip and what had occurred. And maybe this man is my brother. And maybe there is a connection that I have to him. Maybe that separation that I look for, that separation that I really count on, that dualistic thinking that I continue to go back to, that sets me apart and separate from everybody else, that helps box my world so it can make sense to me, is perhaps the kind of thinking that in some way isn't always useful to me. So, two short stories about where we go from here and how we got here and what do. It's a no birth and no death story. A Zen master urged his students to practice diligently in order to transcend the world of birth and death. A student asked him, "Sir, please tell me how to transcend the world of birth and death." He said, "You have to look for the world of no birth and no death." The student asked, "But where can we find the world of no birth and no death?" The Zen master replied, "You look for it right in front of the world of birth and death. In the world of birth and death." Bugs in a Bowl by a Chinese poet, Han Shan. We're just like bugs in a bowl, all day going around, never leaving their bowl. I say, that's right. Every day climbing the steep side, sliding back down. Over and over again, around and around, up and back down. Sit in the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself. Or look around, see your fellow bugs, walk around. Say, "Hey, how you doing?" Say, "Nice bowl." So that's what I have to say about dedication. And again, as I said in the beginning, it really is about focus and quality of mind and developing an understanding of what that quality of mind is and how to maintain the focus. And if I've totally run you rampant all over the world and you're totally unfocused at this point, I apologize, but I appreciate the opportunity to share this with you. So, you have questions, anything you'd like to talk about? We probably have a few moments here. Yeah. Every one of the guys in my group, they come to the practice with a real kind of fire in their belly about it. I think some of them perhaps may have gotten there in part, out of perhaps maybe like with Tip, the crime he had committed had. Was so totally overwhelming for him that he needed something. For some of them, prison is such a different place in the world, and I've heard some of them say that they have learned a lot and are very grateful for having had the opportunity to be stopped. And they're a disparate bunch. They all come there with a very different backgrounds, different reasons, but I think everybody who walks in the door there is dedicated in one way or another. Some of it is about... I deal with a unique population in the sense that there's no reason for them to necessarily come. There's a lot of programs in prison, that look good on your parole record for the parole board. And so there's AA programs or those kind of things, educational programs that a lot of prisoners will engage in. But I must say that there's no reason for them to come other than their own own volition here in our program, because you know we're not gonna get any points for it. Yes. Pardon me?
I want to know why your wife is a nicer person after 10 minutes.
We live very busy lives. And her life is busier than mine for sure, and I'll bet bottom dollar it's a lot about slowing down. It's really about just getting the opportunity to move slower, that for her is very opening. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about, you know, for myself, I feel like there's some kind of reactivity that's just stored in the body, you know, so you're just always on this kind of, you're always so tempted to act out of, it's like something like irritation or something, it's just so permeating the body, and you get 10 days or something like that to just let go of some of it, you know, and just let it settle out a little bit. You're just that less prone to react to the first thing that comes
along. Uh-huh, yeah.
That lasts for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, and for my wife, that's especially true, in the sense that she's, when something happens, she's on it, like, right away. I mean, I'm so totally impressed and by the way that she does get things done. And one of the ways that happens for her is that she, you know, whatever it is that's up, you know, she goes after it, and fixes it. So in that sense, I mean, have you ever done a retreat? I mean, there's a, yeah. Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh, yeah.
I guess I also see it as, you know, very, very personal time.
Yeah, and it's also transcendent time. Because it is a time to slow down and just develop space. I mean, just you know, it's a place to come to a realization that you know, this monkey mind that's always going doesn't always have to go. That there's a different way to different way to look at it. And for me, being in the day-to-day worker world that is jam-packed with a zillion different opportunities and things to do and mortgages to meet, and it's difficult to find those spaces because I'm busy. And retreat is for me one of those places that it does happen in a very large sense. Certainly a larger sense than it even happens here. I mean, you know, because coming to the mat, I think gets us a lot. But it's almost the knowledge of what goes on in those retreats for me that it's one of the reasons I keep coming back to the mat, you know.
So I wonder if you could say a little more about how the commitment thing has gone for you over the last few years. I mean, have you felt steady, or have you dropped it and come back to it, or, you know, has it been, how hard has it been for you to have a daily practice?
Yeah, my practice is you know, I think I started this by all saying I kind of come to this kicking and screaming. And so I do not have a daily practice because my days are eclectic. So A lot of times I'm up and out, you know, or, you know, don't get home till, you know, 9, 10 o'clock at night. And so it's difficult to find the time for a daily practice. Over the years, I would have to say an awful lot of my practice in a lot of ways is developing that day-to-day sense of how to work, how to develop spaces, how to work with your wounds. I do think of it as I do think of like as going to prison as one of the little pieces that I can put out there and put in front of myself as being, you know, some place that I can work on those spaces, work on those wounds, and I think at some level they do work for me. And a non-traditional, you know, Buddhist sense, as you know, like coming to the mat, and the places that works. But this whole point about developing space is a real, while working in the relationship world that way. Is extremely useful in helping you develop, you know, the sense of sitting still, or for my case, the sense of not running away, even, you know, is real important. And so that's it's the same kind of practice in that sense, you know, that coming to the mat does give you.
Yeah, I've always had a kind of erratic relationship with daily practice. And I've done a lot of retreats and I find it much easier. And for some reason it's over the years it's been sometimes easy and sometimes difficult to actually do the daily, you know, the commitment to the daily practice.
Yeah. And yet it's one of those things that for a lot of people works extremely well.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I like myself better when I do it. I mean, it's like the same result as, you know, you say your wife gets from a 10-day retreat. You know, the days when I sit go better than the days when I don't.
Uh huh.
I just seem to be very slow at learning that and applying it in a committed way.
Yeah. 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 There's. One place in prison. Some of this, it really is a lot about. You know, I've been talking a little bit tonight about distractions, one thing that's probably very true for at least the prison population is just this whole business of distractions and how. There isn't the opportunity for reinforcement for being for practice. It's a noisy place. While we can come here and reinforce our reason for being here, and just trying to work out, you know, why it is that we're here, we have that opportunity, and in prison you really don't have that opportunity. That weekly practice is the only thing those guys have that really gives them that community to work some of that stuff out. And I'm, you know, in terms of and for those guys, for work, you know, for the task and challenge that they have in terms of working with their stuff, you know, working with a sense of of the suffering that they have to deal with. It's hard. It's really hard. So for a lot of them, as a matter of fact, I have a couple of daily meditators in my group. They get up first thing in the morning, and it's one of the quietest times. You know, it's a really great time to sit. I mean, you know, if I can sit in the morning, if I can get myself on the mat in the morning, it's a great time to pull it off, because providing you don't fall back asleep. Because the mind is so very quiet in the morning, it hasn't had the opportunity to start rolling into the day, it's one of those times that I think is a good time. A lot of other people I know do it in the evening, just before they go to bed as well. The other really a great advice I think is works extremely well for some people is just 5 minutes. I mean, sit for 5 minutes. I mean, you know, it's just that little bit of, you know, kind of opportunity to remember that this is worth doing. You know, or any other space you can create during the day. Even if it isn't on the mat, even if it's just a breath, a deep breath that you can take in the middle of the day when maybe something that would trigger it, like Pema's suggestion about realizing that maybe you're in a negative state. That you're in a dualistic state, and maybe that's a place for a breath to occur, a long, slow, deep breath.